Thanks for tuning in to Men for the Win, a podcast hosted by David Kufis and Dan Thompson, two avid fans who appreciate well-played baseball, especially when it's done by the Twins. Men for the Win is sponsored by the Grand Group with Edina Realty. Are you looking to purchase a new home in the Twin Cities area? Or perhaps you're trying to sell your current home? Whether you're upsizing or downsizing, the Grand Group with Edina Realty will meet all of your housing needs. Contact the Grand Group by emailing thegrangroup@edinarealty.com or call them by phone at 612-817-8751. The Grand Group with Edina Realty, three-time Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine Super Agent Award winners.
On this episode, David, Dan, and Hoags recap the Twins' terrible 2022 baseball campaign. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Thanks for tuning in to Men for the Win. My name is David Kufis. With me, as always, is Dan Thompson. And as a special treat, Andrew Hoags Hoganson joins the program. This will be a disappointing time, folks. I'm not going to lie to you. We will try and be upbeat and entertaining, but the Twins season has come to a close with the final record being 78-84, a mere 14 games back from the AL Central winning Cleveland Indians, who we are patiently waiting.
Guardians. No. You went the whole season doing well with that, and then you call them the Guardians right there.
All season.
Or the Indians.
I can't even believe it. Sorry. Anyway, 14 games behind the Cleveland Guardians, who are still waiting to play Game 5 in the division series against the Yankees, and they are three games back from the Chicago White Sox. Not a great campaign, boys. How are we feeling? Have we started to come up a little bit from the season-ending depression, or are we still down in the dumps?
I think you characterized the season a little unfairly. I don't think it was a miserable season. Was that the word you used?
Well, just like as a whole, the ending was terrible. Yes, there were points of the season that were nice.
I don't look at a 78-84 season as miserable. I look at it as disappointing. But compared to my prediction, which we'll get to, was almost spot on.
That's such a Minnesota sports fan's attitude right there. We were four games under 500, but you know what? It was fine. We figured it out. But you guys kind of, I wanted to get after you on this. You asked my question in one of the podcasts where you said, was this the most disappointing Twin season ever as a fan? Dan, you're an English teacher. You should know the importance of words. Disappointing is the wrong word that I wanted to ask in that. Heartbreaking. Was it the most heartbreaking season? Because obviously the Twins have come in with higher expectations than they did this year. But I think what made this year so frustrating for me, at least, was they weren't supposed to be as good as they started off playing. And then it was just a slow bleed for 4 months after a decent start to the year. And I think that's what made it so heartbreaking for me.
Well, so that's a good point, Hoax, because Mariners fans out here have been, you know, so sad about the way that their season ended. And I was like, yeah, that was a regular series for the Twins, right?
Oh,
it was three games by a run after you had, you know, one of them you blow a 6-run lead or whatever it was. I mean, like, yeah, welcome to the party. That's how we always feel. So yes, there was heartbreak, and I think looking through the Mariners lens, I'm reminded of how much more heartbreak the Twins had this season than other teams did.
To answer your question about, like, am I healing over this year? And this is sad, but once teams start getting eliminated from the playoffs and I realize that, oh, we'd be gone already anyways, then I start feeling better about it, because at this point in time, we'd be done anyways. So, you know, it's time to move on.
It's true. Finding that silver lining. Yeah. So right now, the NL, it will be the Phillies versus the Padres in the championship series. And then the Houston Astros are anxiously awaiting the winner of the Guardian v. Yankee series that I don't know that they're ever going to finish. This is, I don't know what, day 14 of postponements due to inclement weather. Well, with that, boys, I think we've talked enough about other baseball teams. Let's get on to our beloved Twins. And we're going to start this off going through our 2022 predictions, which we gave in our season opener show. And so we all gave sort of our thoughts for different categories, and we're going to go through what we said at the time, what the actual results were for the season, and then obviously make fun of each other in the moments in which that is deserved.
Spoiler alert for this segment: when David said we're going to give our results and then what actually happened, those will be the same for me. It'll be what I said and what actually happened. Turns out is pretty much the same this year. I may not have done well at Puckett's picks, but man, I did well here.
I don't like the first category. I think this is misleading about my baseball acumen. This is an emotional call. I have to say, you're going to make me say this. All right. Yeah. So I picked the most home runs, Miguel Sano. I picked Miguel Sano to hit 41 home runs, guys. That was off by 40 and not in the direction we would have hoped.
I mean, I don't think even if he stayed on the Gulf Coast League, Dan, I don't think he hits 41.
Did he even have 41 at bats for the Twins?
He might have. If he did, it was he had 40 strikeouts to go with it. That one home run. What a terrible season for Miguel Sano, and we will probably never see him again in the Twins uniform. Hopefully, I think at this point.
Yeah. So I took Gary Sanchez with 27 home runs, which, to be fair, was I think more realistic. He had 16 home runs on the season, and I would argue he didn't have a very good season overall. But Hoags, you went with a different approach.
Yep, I picked Byron Buxton, and even though he only played 98 games or whatever this year, he ended up coming through and hitting the most for the Twins, which is, I mean, it's sad that ended up happening is Buxton hit 28. When you look back at this team, and they were the Bomba Squad in 2019 to go into their leading home run hitter, only hit 28 home runs in 98 games. It's kind of sad to see where this team has fallen off offensively. I mean, the ball has something to do with it, yes, but still, a lot of that power's gone.
Well, we were all right on the batting average, though, so we all picked Luis Arraez in various degrees. I had him at 310. Kufis, you had him at 308. Hoags, though, 315. Look at that.
One off. He ended up with 316. So this continues my streak. That's 2 for 2, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.
And it does need to be noted, of course, that Arraez did win the batting title over Aaron Judge. Very exciting time for Arraez. And of course, like I've said before, very redeeming for Dan, who brings up the Terry Francona quote at every opportunity to talk about how Francona knew that Arraez would win a batting title.
I'm just waiting for him to make some other Twins prediction, right? Can he, like where is his Chris Archer prediction? He didn't have one of those, I noticed.
Chris Archer 2023 Cy Young. That's what we're going to hear.
Well, and then it's really no secret, obviously. Next is on-base percentage, and we all took... Oh, no, excuse me. We didn't all take Arraez. Hoags and I both took Arraez, which was the correct call here. Arraez had an on-base percentage of 375, but Dan, you went with Correa.
I did, because I had a lot of faith in Correa at the beginning that he was going to love it in Minnesota so much. He ended up with 366, which was not that far behind Luis Arraez. That was second best on the team.
That's true. That's true. If we go forward here to OPS.
Hold on a minute. We need to mention that I called his on-base percentage exactly. He ended up with a 375 on-base percentage, which is exactly what I picked. So now, folks, for those keeping score at home, I am now 3 for 3 on-base percentage exactly and batting average off by 1,000th.
He needs to soak this up, though, because now his streak comes to a close. So OPS, we all took Buxton, actually. Dan had him at .905. I had him at .916. And Hoags had him at .9.
Is that .900? Is that what it's supposed to be?
No, .9. Just that's how I like it, Dan.
.9.
So Correa actually led the team with OPS at .833 on the season.
But here's the thing. Hoags did have another. Doesn't he have another win here in ERA for starters? So I picked Joe Ryan with 3.73. Or is that how I'm supposed to say it without the dot? Now you've confused me, Kubis, with this dot.
If there's a whole number, you don't say the dot, Dan.
Okay. And then, David, you had Sonny Gray with a 3.85 ERA. And then Hoags had him with a 4 ERA just on the dot. And Gray beat all of his predictions. He had an ERA of 3.08.
You do wonder, though, with some of his starts that were limited due to injury and then the starts that he missed due to injury, do you think this would be higher if he would have had more starts?
I think it would have been lower if he would have been healthier throughout the year. I mean, honestly, I didn't really realize that he had got that low of an ERA throughout the whole course of the year, but he was solid. Him and Ryan were both solid at the top of that rotation.
And they both beat our predictions, right? Joe Ryan finished with an ERA of 3.55. To have two guys like that at the top of your rotation is not bad. And I know we'll talk about this later, but with the rotation that they should have next season, they should have a good rotation, shouldn't they?
This will be the first offseason that I can remember where the number one headline wasn't Twins need starting pitching.
And go figure, because their approach always seems to get criticized by a large portion of at least the loudest portion of the Twins fan base, that they don't go out and sign guys. But you look at the guys that they have chosen not to sign, and so many of them have not had great seasons, even 2 years out signing a big deal. So I think this is in some ways vindicating of one thing about this front office that I think it's doing well.
Fair, but it's also very fair to criticize them for Schumacher and Happ and Bundy and Archer. I mean, those, you can't say those turned out well, but...
Those, they had trade value. Schumacher was traded for what, like a first round pick or something for the Cardinals? It was
That's
fantastic.
What it was.
You got to be real careful about your J.A. Happ comparisons here, Hoax, because Dan
it's
gets
just
a little
J.
bit...
Yeah, it's just J.
We
Happ.
Decided
it's not
J.A. Happ.
It's J.A. Happ. That's what he said.
No, it's J.A.
You can kind of slur it with like a J.A.
It's J.A. I think, to David there.
J.A.
That's it. I got to work on a few more dots. Anyway, next statistic that we decided in our infinite wisdom to give our predictions for was ERA for reliever. And this is sort of funny, but Dan did the best. He didn't get it correct, but he did the best. He had Caleb Thielbar at 3.14. I had Tyler Duffy. That worked out really well at 2.75. And then Hoax picked a guy who didn't even play one game for the Twins, Taylor Rogers, with a 3.5 ERA. I don't know what his ERA ended up as. Maybe that's what was pretty close to what it was with the Padres.
So do I win because I was the only guy who still had a Twins player at the end of the season here picked for this category?
I mean, I guess if there's a winner, I guess it would have to be Dan, but it was actually Duran finished the season at 1.86, and clearly he's going to be instrumental to the Twins bullpen for the foreseeable future.
I just looked it up, and Taylor Rogers had a 4.77 ERA. So, I mean, going off of Dan's point, another guy that, you know, maybe it was, I mean, not that the return worked out so well for Rod, still, he kind of did fall off a lot. But yeah, Duran is going to be the end of the bullpen for years to come. Now, he looked absolutely incredible this year. All of us were excited when he was making the team out of the gate, but a 1.86 ERA and how impressive that 1.86 actually was unreal this year.
I just want to see next year a great package when he comes in as the actual closer for the team. Like, I want something that's Joe Nathan-esque, Glenn Perkins, even Fernando Rodney. You know, I want something that's really going to get that target field hopping.
Little Edwin Diaz.
Like a video package? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, no, like the sound. And you know, each of those guys had their different walkout music, and they did the same sort of videography and whatnot. I want that. I want that.
Can they play a Duran Duran song? Like, wouldn't that be okay. the
so
thing to do?
Here's the thing. Okay, here's the thing. This is not a time for puns, Dan. This is supposed to be a very intense bringing in the closer time, and Duran Duran does not fit that bill.
80s boy band doesn't say that to you? Like,
New Kids
they did
on the
a Bond
block.
Song once.
The Edwin Diaz trumpets right now, I think, is the best in baseball right now. That one is absolutely incredible. They do kind of like turn down the lights and have the fire come up for Duran, but it just, I don't know, it's not as memorable as other guys that we've had. Like, even Taylor Rogers with the chain, like that was awesome too.
Yeah.
So hopefully they come up with something.
Well, so then we have the next category, which is somewhat subjective, I'd say, is the season MVP. And both Hoax and I took Correa, and that's who I would argue is the season MVP. Dan took Buxton with a little bit higher numbers than Buxton ended up with. His slashes were .290, .340, and .905.
That was my prediction, for the record. That's not what he actually ended up with, unfortunately.
No, sorry. I thought I made that clear. That was not what Buxton ended up with.
I think the part that surprised me the most there was his average, right? He actually finished with an average of .224, way under, and I think a lot of that I would have to contribute to injuries. He just wasn't he wasn't hitting for average this year, because I think he was just swinging for home runs every time he was up there.
Yeah, I think his body was just in such rough shape that he just basically had like a swing hard and that was it. There wasn't much activity on the bases that we're normally used to from him. So yeah, that it's amazing the numbers that he put up with thinking about what he must have been going through throughout the year.
So there was a poll put together by Aaron Gleeman. So he sort of did his MVP candidates for the Twins. And then he also put a poll out that people could vote in. And it was very close between Correa, Arise, and Duran, but Correa did edge out the competition. However, do you guys all agree with that, or would you maybe put Arise above Correa, or maybe did Duran have that large of an impact that he would be in the running?
It's so hard to define MVP, you know what I mean? Because Correa, while he had a great year, he did almost exactly what he was supposed to do. That shouldn't be taken away from him, because he is an amazing baseball player, so it makes sense that he is the MVP. Arise had a decent year too, but you could argue that you'd hope for his average to be even higher than it was. It was kind of a down year in the AL in general. I think you can make a solid case for Duran meaning the most to them in terms of wins, though, because if you don't have him at the back end of that bullpen, this team loses so many more games.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I realize it's all, if you got to pick one, you're not going to pick these guys. But Jose Miranda, I mean, the difference that he made coming in and having the rookie season that he did, you know, Nick Gordon, who was able to fill in so many spots. I know he wasn't great, but the guy finished with a .272 batting average. I mean, he had 405 at bats. Why are you shaking your head? I'm not saying he's the most valuable player, but
is he even in this conversation, Dan? I don't even understand. He's not in the list.
But he should have been. I just think he's deserving of some credit. That's what I wanted to say here. Yeah,
but not for most valuable player.
I guess,
Dan.
I agree with you on that.
I guess if you say most valuable guy off the bench, sure. Like, if you want to give Gordon the sixth man of the year award, I guess that's fine.
Isn't it a 10th man in baseball? Yeah. They have nine positions, David.
You know, folks, sometimes when we take breaks from the podcast, I forget what I deal with when I come onto the show. And the puns that just keep running at me here. But anyway, enough with the season MVP. On to the seasoned LVP, which is the least valuable player. And we all had some thoughts here.
There's a lot of options.
Dan, there are. Dan took Kepler, which I think, to be fair, he should definitely be in the conversation.
I think he should be, too. He was almost spot on in my average. He hit .227, 9 home runs, which is disappointing to me, because if he's going to be a pull hitter into the shift, he's got to, at some point, hit it over the shift, and he's got to do it more than 9 times. And he did play 115 games. It wasn't like this is a really small sample size. We keep waiting for Max Kepler to have this all-star year, because I think we hoped at some point he might at least pop and have one great season.
That's the problem when you're only playing with 5 toes. It's just really hard to get out there, and it's not as easy.
And you would think his toes would have extra durability due to his dancer parents.
That gets into nurture and nature there, David. I don't think we're ready for that that kind of discussion. But I'm running because, David, you have a pretty good LVP here, too.
So I took Miguel Sano, and Hoags mentioned before we went live that the numbers that I gave for Sano, Hoags said he would have been happy with if he was still on the team and performed as well as I said he would have to in order to be the least valuable player on the team.
I mean, they're not bad. You picked him at .230, .285, .690 with 10 home runs and 30 RBIs. I mean, I would have taken that off the bench this year.
Maybe. I don't know. I still think that Miguel Sano not being on this team was as helpful as some of the most valuable players being on the team.
Well, Hoags, your pick is kind of interesting here. You went with a pitcher.
Yeah. Which...
Ironically, because he only pitches once every 5 days. You know, you wouldn't think that you could qualify for least valuable
in
your book.
The Dan Thompson beast versus bench method for this one. Yeah, and Bundy was kind of weird because you guys were ripping me right at the beginning of the year because he started off just so strong, and turns out that lasted about 3 starts and then he went down the drain. But yeah, there's just way too many options for this. I don't even know who you could pick. Half the team, you could pick half the bullpen that would be your least valuable player. But to me, I think in retrospect, it's clearly Pagan. Like no one blew more games, no one caused more angst, no one just defeated rallies more, no one lost more games to the Guardians. I mean, I could go on, but I don't want to.
I will, because this is funny. He appeared in 59 games, which I think it's more than Duran. It's less than Jax, of all people, and Caleb Thielbar. But like, how many of those 59 games were we just holding our breath for every pitch that he threw?
It was a rough go, especially for how long Rocco insisted on sticking with Pagan in those situations.
I mean, he was 9 of 16 for save opportunities. 9 of 16.
As a team, this was embarrassing. I didn't realize this. 28 saves in 55 opportunities.
Oh, that is horrible. That's what I mean. Most heartbreaking season. Like, that's a stat I should have looked up and used for my argument right there.
Can I say, I want to say one thing about Dylan Bundy. He did make more starts than anybody else on the team. And I think that does actually count for something. He made his turn, I think, almost every time it came up.
I guess that's something to be said, certainly. I don't know. Like, I think Pagan is probably the right answer. But again, Kepler should be in that conversation. Sano should be in that conversation. Sanchez to some extent. And then Palacios, for as little as he played, man, he had more errors than most of the other infielders combined.
And yet somebody claimed him.
Yeah, and
right?
Now he's gone. Now he's gone. It's just wild. And Jake Cave's gone too. R.I.P.
Which I am so disappointed because Dan and I had been talking about Sounders for next season, and we were going to have a Jake Cave warning signal. So whenever an outfielder got injured, we'd play the sirens, and then it'd be Jake Cave warning.
We still could keep it, Kufis. I mean, it's possible, yeah, it's right? They could always trade for him.
The part I'm going to miss the most is the mirror, is the you are Jake Cave. There was like a solid week where I'd get up and go to work and I would look at myself in the mirror and I would start laughing thinking, you are Jake Cave.
All right, well, we have one last prediction to look at. It's our record predictions. How about Hogs? You go first. We'll go right to left.
Well, I picked them at a solid 81-81, and honestly, it ended up pretty close to the truth. Which that's what's so weird about this year, because none of us. I mean, you look at the records that we picked. None of us picked anything to be that amazing, and it still feels frustrating right now because it looked like it was going to be better for a while.
Yeah, I had them at 88-74, making the postseason and losing in the division series, but unfortunately, obviously, that looked pretty good at the All-Star break. Like, that looked like, hey, you know what? This could be right on track, and then they just imploded. And so it was very disappointing that they finished out. I would have loved my record prediction to come true.
Yeah, and I had 80-82 missing the playoffs as well. It's disappointing no matter how you cut it when your team misses the playoffs, but I think it is a little bit more painful in some ways when they could have made the playoffs, when they were in position to make the playoffs, and the way that they just fell apart at the end.
Well, and we keep talking about this throughout this whole podcast. They had some very strong individual performances. Like, some of these guys, I mean, Correa had a great year. I mean, there's so many impressive seasons that these guys had, but not enough to string together. And the back end and the depth was just awful.
So I do want to give us a little bit of comfort in that we were not the only ones incorrect in our predictions. Because my goodness, folks, if you look at some of the early season predictions put out by major publications, a lot of them had the Twins over 500 and at least in contention for the AL Central. But my favorite stat when going through all of these predictions early in the season was the Athletic. They put on their predictions about who will win the AL Central. And the Guardians had a 0% chance to win the AL Central. It went White Sox with 84% of the vote, then the Tigers with 9%, the Twins with 6%, and the Royals and Guardians both with 0%.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. It was not quite inverted, but the fact that the Guardians were picked to finish last and finish first, really it's a credit to Terry Francona, I think, gentlemen, and his foresight, managerial skill.
They didn't even want to win this year. They didn't do anything at the trade deadline.
That's true.
They slashed their payroll that was already historically low last year. I mean, you look at the pitchers that they've had and who they've gotten rid of and who they still have, and they're still performing well. It's hard not to root for the guys in that locker room because their front office doesn't even want them to win.
Not for David. David has no problem rooting against the Guardians.
Okay, so you're rooting for the Yankees right now, Mr. Kufis.
No,
that's what you would like to tell me?
No, hang on. There are some caveats here. I would like the Guardians to beat the Yankees, to beat the Astros, and then lose to whatever NL team makes the World Series.
But how do you dislike them? Like, they don't have anyone that's I mean, Jose Ramirez is great. Who do you dislike on that team?
It's not about the individual. See, you and Dan get so caught up in this. Like, Dan has posters of Aaron Judge, the life-size fathead on his wall that he kisses before bed each night. But, like, I don't get invested into these players personally. Like, there's some team loyalty that you need to have here, Hoax. So you're telling me that, like, if the Vikings are in the postseason and the Packers don't make the postseason, you're cheering for the Vikings because you really like Adam Thielen?
No, but I'm telling you that when the Big Ten is in bowl games, I'm going to root for the Big Ten to win every single bowl game.
I don't like the analogy.
I don't. I'll jump. I just don't hold a lot of...
It's the same analogy you just gave.
What do you mean?
It's the same conference. So you're rooting for your teams in the conference. For football, I don't in the NFL, but I do for college.
Why do you differentiate that?
Do you differentiate for college football?
No. I'm the one who's holding to a consistent standard here, Hoax. You're the one who's picking and choosing your sports and how you decide to cheer for opposing teams. Not me.
So about this? Like, last year with the Wild and the Avs, like, did either of you root for the Avs?
No, I wanted them to get destroyed afterwards.
Okay.
Now, why? Hoax, you're arguing against yourself right here. Do you see this? Like, you're making the point that I am making.
Fans want an ejection. There it goes.
And that was Guardy's gripe.
I don't want the Guardians to do anything. I actually would be fine if the Astros beat the Guardians, but it's kind of fun just to rile you up.
Well, this makes no sense. I can't.
For the record, I am actually rooting for the Guardians. I am rooting for the Guardians. So am I the only one here then? Now, if we determine that?
Well, according to Holmes' logic, I have no idea who he's cheering for and when.
All right, let's move on here to something more cordial, shall we?
I don't know if there's anything more cordial on this list here, Dan. No sense over here. Okay, so let's take a little break from the Twins. Take a little break from the Twins, and let's just talk about some of the rules changes or things that came into effect into baseball this year. First off,
this is how you want to calm us down? You're going to talk about the rule changes?
I for anything to get away from your just wild Willy Wonka world of logic for who you cheer for.
I wish you all could see David right now, because there was some really nice dancing going on during that.
He wasn't singing. He could have sang The World of Pure Imagination for us there, but he had nothing.
It's because he doesn't have a song in his heart.
All right. Well, if we're going to talk about rule changes, I feel like there were rule changes made we didn't even know were going to happen. I feel like at the beginning of the season, baseball was like throwing darts at a rule board and saying, oh, let's try that this week. That was the thing that drove me nuts, was there were rules we didn't even really know were being changed, and there they were.
Yeah, so let's talk about real quick. This one I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on, but the universal DH went into effect. Does anybody care? Like, did it seem like that large of a change or impact?
I do, because I still like, if a pitcher throws at a guy, he should have to be in the batter's box. But really, when it was in practice and with the ability to play every other team now and have just a completely even schedule, fine. Let's get rid of it. It's fine.
Yeah, I was fine with it, too. I like it. I like that it extends careers of baseball players in productive ways. I do miss, you know, Madison Bumgarner hitting, things like that. But no problem, really.
So then the other thing that was interesting, this was the first season where umps would wear microphones and they would announce the replay reviews to fans. What did we think about that?
Didn't care at all. It didn't add anything. It didn't subtract anything. I don't care. Like, just tell me if you say, I could make, there's two motions in baseball, the safe motion and the out motion. I don't need words along with it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think at enough football games, I don't get to hear what the umps or the referees are saying anyway, because I don't remember to turn the microphone on and things like that. Yeah, I don't know that I cared that much. I did like that there seemed to be a little bit more. Like, I like that late in games, there's not so concerned about, well, you have a challenge left or you don't have a challenge left. Like, baseball does seem to have a reasonableness about when to try to look at a replay. And I thought they were pretty fleet, pretty quick doing it for the most part.
But what is that rule? Because technically teams do have one challenge, but you can still ask them to challenge. And I just remember Bramer when we were watching, like, Baldelli did it like three times in one inning. And they're like, is there a limit? Like, I guess we're gonna find out. Like, he just keeps going.
I think that there's some things that need to be learned from college football in a lot of ways. And one of them is just, if it's a close play that you think should be reviewed, then the umpires should be able to review it. Like, I don't know why we have to do this whole song and dance with, oh, we want you to, you know, Rocco. How many times do we have to see Rocco make the headphones motion? Like, my goodness. Like, if it was a close play at first and the ump isn't certain, take 2 seconds and have someone in New York look at it.
Well, and it's just stupid, too, when, like, both defenses are on the field, too, and everyone's just like, nope, we're not. Like, it's just, yeah, it is a song and dance. The other thing, too, that I just want to point out with talking about that is still watching Rocco yell at the umpires when Sanchez got called for blocking the plate, when they were the ones who ultimately agreed with him originally, and you're yelling at someone who is like, hey, man, I made the same call that you did. I got overturned, too.
That was a great moment. I mean, Rocco, again, so articulate when he's frustrated. I wish I had that gift.
Again, he just couldn't get the flailing down. The so flailing funny. And the marking with the hand, like, it's just a little bit delayed. Just a little delayed. Hopefully he works on that in the offseason.
It's almost better if you watch it on mute so that you can't, like, even see, like, what any of, like, Bramer's or is saying. And you just see his words clearly not matching his hands. Like, I didn't, when you said that, I don't even know what you're talking about. And then I watched it again. I'm like, oh, wow. It's so noticeable. Like, he doesn't know how to get mad.
No, it was a glitch in the matrix here. Like, is his words kept coming and his arms kept moving and they were just not in rhythm. I would be very shocked if Rocco is musical at all. Because
no
anybody
way.
Who has a song in their heart would be able to hit those downbeats with their anger.
Maybe he's like a drum major. You know how they put the offbeat down and then it doesn't line up with what the band is playing? Maybe that's his background. We should look that up.
Okay. Other rules here. So the MLB allowing pitchers to use this anti-sign stealing technology where the catchers are actually wearing a wristband and that actually speaks to the pitchers through a speaker in their hats. What did we think about that?
I kind of forgot it was happening. Like, I think because the Twins so rarely seem to have guys on second base or stealing, for that matter. Like, it didn't seem to be an issue in a lot of Twins baseball games.
Yeah, I didn't care about it at all either. I did think it was funny that some pitchers were like, it sounds so loud. I feel like everyone in the whole stadium can hear what pitch I'm supposed to be throwing.
It's weird, though, because I think the only time that I noticed it is when there was an issue with the technology, right? Like the rest of the game, I didn't pay attention to it at all.
That's true. And there seemed to be a lot of issues with it. Or maybe, again, maybe it's confirmation bias, but yes, you would think that they could get a simple like Bluetooth speaker to work on a baseball field.
Any other rules changes? I know Dan got real upset about the Ohtani rule. I don't know if Hoags, you had any thoughts on that.
Well, that one is stupid because it's another rule that they were basically like halfway through, the, or not even halfway through the year, but with the year started like, oh, yeah, maybe we should figure a way out how he can keep batting even after he's done pitching. I hate it. I think it's stupid. It should be the same for everybody. Like, yeah, he is incredible. He is the best baseball player that we will see in our lifetime. But why do we have a rule just to allow him to do something that's different? That makes no sense to me. Try to argue with me on this one.
You
I'm
think
excited
that he's the
this.
Greatest baseball player
Without
that we'll see in our lifetime?
Without a shadow of a doubt. It's not even close.
Do you mean that in terms of just pure baseball skill? Like, because he can hit and pitch?
Yeah, it's basically like he's like a Bo Jackson, but of the exact same sport. Like, it is unprecedented. You can't even say like Babe Ruth, because that was a completely different era.
I think what's strange to me about baseball in general along these lines is that so many high school baseball players, they are their team's best pitcher and their team's best hitter. And there's something that just goes away. It's like that they have to specialize in college baseball or in minor leagues that I do think is just a little bit strange. Like, if like surely there are other Major League Baseball players who, if they had chosen to, and I don't know if this is true, but is Mike Trout, like surely Mike Trout was a good pitcher at some point in his life. Like, why do they have to pick?
I always wonder that when I see Correa like whip a ball over to first base and it's 93 miles an hour as he's like throwing off balance. You kind of wonder like, man, I wonder if that guy could pitch.
David, you don't seem to care about this debate.
Just mad.
Just a quizzical look.
I just still can't get over this idea that Hoags is convinced that Ohtani is the greatest baseball player we will see in our lifetime.
Well, if someone comes up and as we're 70 years old and hits his 850th home run, you can make me eat dirt. But, I mean, it seems unlikely. Are you picking Mike Trout above him now? I mean, who are you going to pick?
Well, I'm confused what the parameters are, first of all. Like, I guess you're saying, sure, could I say that Ohtani is the best player who both pitches and hits? Sure. But I guess I don't know that I'm going to say, well, that because he has the skill to do that, that means he's the greatest baseball player ever.
But he's great at both. Like, he's not just good at both. He's great at both.
I don't know. We'll have to see. I'm not convinced. I'd have to think about this a little bit further, but I think the flippant nature with which you put forth that comment made me question it, and because you said it. Anything that comes out of Hoags' mouth, I gotta take a second before I agree with.
I was gonna say,
what else did you even talk about there, Hoags? Was there a point to that before Ohtani?
I don't remember.
Oh, it's the Ohtani rule. That's what we're all right. Oh, okay. Yeah, never mind. I thought it was something else.
Just for the right, record, David, have you ever heard me say anything that wasn't flippant? Like, I feel like you keep getting surprised by some of these.
Well, it just bothers me that if you play out the logic that you're using for some of the things that you're saying, you can't possibly agree with them.
Ohtani, stand by the Ohtani one 100%.
In like 15 minutes, you're going to tell me it's a different person. And then I'm going to say, but hang on. And you're going to be like, no, I was just trying to get you going.
All right, I'm going to jump in. So I do want to say this because there were other rule changes, and I know we talked about it kind of throughout the season. There was the, you know, you can't trot a position player out there if you're not behind or ahead by six or more runs. There was obviously the huge change of the bases being made bigger by a few inches. But I mean,
the huge change. I love
that
how
is going
to
be
I love how
groundbreaking.
Rick. About this one.
Ricky Henderson is going to lose all of his records now because somebody's going to think that they can steal extra bases now. It's a big change, gentlemen. That's going to revolutionize the game.
Yeah, I do need to point out here, the Twins were last in the AL in stolen bases with 38. So I don't think Henderson needs to lose any sleep over the Twins roster.
Well, we got Billy Hamilton, so maybe if we keep him on the team next year, we'll get a few more stolen bases.
You know, if they added a 27th roster spot, I think Billy Hamilton is the perfect candidate for that.
Is there any other rule change that we need to talk about before we move back into our beloved Twins team?
No, I don't think so. We'll have plenty more to talk about next year when they make up some other rule to change in May.
So let's move forward here. We did talk about this the last episode of the season, but we do want to mention the Puckett's Picks results again in case anybody forgot.
Catch them all, Kirby Puckett!
Puckett's Picks winner.
I did come away with the victory on the season with 20 wins. Dan had 16 wins and the listeners had 15 wins. Dan, would you like to give the point totals? I know that you're so fond of.
I would love to. So David was last in the point total with 226. Hoag's and the listeners were 227, and I was far and away ahead with 265. I feel really good about that there. I'm going to hang my hat on that one for years to come.
Well, you can, but it doesn't matter. It's just my guys knew when to give up. They're like, you know what? We're not going to win this one. We sit them down. It's like putting a position player in. Same idea.
So David, you put together this more charts. By the way, this spreadsheet that you have put together with all of our notes, like I can't even fit it on two monitors. Like I have to I need a wall monitor to put all this. But you included some stats about Puckett's picks.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting to look at these. And again, I didn't do a breakdown for each player on the Twins. I only used these players when they were picked. But so the player who was picked most often, not surprisingly, was Carlos Correa. He was picked 38 times. He had 174 points out of the times that he was picked, and he won 14 times. But what's interesting, the next highest pick player was Arise at 27, and he also had 14 wins. So you had a better chance of winning with Arise, even though he was picked 11 times less than Correa on the season.
We kind of said that all year when we were talking about it, how Arise was consistent and he was always going to be in the running, but you just get greedy. Like you'd want to get that 11-pointer, that chance at a 20-pointer instead of the 8 to 12 you knew you were going to get with Arise.
That's why I picked Nick Gordon so often. I was just looking for those 15-point series he had twice.
I mean, I think the saddest ratio, though, is certainly Byron Buxton, who was picked 26 times but only won 7 times on the season.
And for the first month of the season, like none of us could get him because Buxton was always being picked by the listeners.
Correct. And that did not work out for them.
I feel like I need to publicly apologize to the listeners. I feel like if my picks were taken out and it was just everyone else picking, that we actually may have had a chance this year. But I was the kiss of death like all year long. Outside of my like 3-series Miranda run that I had, it was pretty bad.
Yeah, you did have that stretch that made it interesting towards the end of the season where you had, 3 or 4 victories in a row.
Kuvis, are we ready to move on here to the segments?
Yeah, let's get moving here. So what we do here, folks, if you don't listen to the program every episode, we do sort of a brief series recap, and then we have different segments that we go through. And so we're actually going to do the segment section, but we're going to do it from a whole season perspective as opposed to an individual series during the season.
Beast versus bench.
Is losing fun?
All right, so one of our segments is Beast versus Bench, where we pick the player that we thought was the most important player, the most valuable player, he's our beast. And then somebody that we think maybe would have been better off on the bench. Unless Hoag's occasionally took this metaphorically. I think one time he actually picked the bench physically for one of his segments here.
I got to be honest, I wanted to do it again today. It took everything in me not to do it.
Well, Hoag's, how about you start us here with your beast?
I went with Correa. I think even though he had about the year that we thought he would have, I don't want to penalize him for that. He was incredible, especially in September at the end of the year. And it got overlooked so much because the Twins just played so horribly. I think he's clearly the MVP. I do want to give a quick shout out to Joe Ryan as an honorable mention. Coming back after the year that he had at the end of the year last year and still performing as well as he did this year, I think it's hard to live up to those expectations, especially when hitters start to see you a few more times. And so I was really impressed with the numbers that he ended up turning out this year too.
Yeah, so I'm going to piggyback. I'm going to go with Correa as well. It's just hard to deny his body of work and what he meant to this team. Clearly, he's a leader on the field, and he really worked hard, I think, to build a championship culture, but just failed to produce.
Well, gentlemen, I went with the batting champion, Luis Arraez. I don't know how you didn't go with this guy. I mean, he was a rock star at the top of the lineup, even when he was a little bit hurt towards the end of the year. I just think you can't overstate the Joe Mauer-esque season that Luis Arraez had.
This is another sounder that we're going to add. Every time Dan mentions Joe Mauer, we're going to have a little bell ding or something.
Steady Eddie out there. I mean, that's what you want out of him.
Well, then let's take our attention and put it to bench. Who do you have on your bench there, Hoags?
See, this is where I wanted to pick the bench again. I wanted to pick the bench because they just didn't do anything this year. Our backups didn't, but I went with Gary Sanchez because I was one who was preaching that this was going to be a huge bounce back year from him without being under the New York lights and the New York media, and he had every opportunity with Jeffers out for the majority of the year, and he did not produce at all of where we thought that he could be. So I think he's the clear-cut loser for me on this one.
Yeah, I went with Alex Kirilloff. And the reason is that we had such high hopes for Alex Kirilloff ever since he made that playoff start against the Astros that David hated so much. I mean, he only played 45 games in this season, 144 at-bats. And it also felt like the Twins missed like a 3.5-week window where he was just rocking it at AAA. And he wasn't up with the Twins. And he had a couple good weeks here and there. But for the most part, and I know this is largely out of his control, like the guy's dealing with a pretty painful bone injury. At the same time, I just thought he underperformed our hopes so much. And think of how different this lineup looks if Alex Kirilloff gives you 400 or 500 at-bats.
Well, and it should be noted that when Kirilloff was picked for Puckett's picks, it's disappointing he didn't come away with a victory, but he was only picked 4 times. He had 21 points, which means he was positive every single time he was picked. So clearly, he was productive when he was up to at least some extent, especially when you compare him with the other outfield options who we were throwing out there.
Yeah, David, who's on your bench?
So I'm going to give it to Kepler. And I think mainly because, yeah, his season numbers weren't great, clearly. But I do think that there was sort of an expectation. Remember when we signed Polanco and Sano and Kepler to these like sort of long-term deals? And we were all pretty excited about it because we thought, you know what? You're locking these guys up pretty long-term. And if even one of them hits, I think this will look like a good signing by the Twins. And clearly, Polanco has played well when he's been healthy. But Kepler never took that next step. And to Dan's point that he said a lot this season, well, what happens next year when there's no longer a shift for him to hit into? Will his numbers really increase that much? And I'm not sure, but the number of times I saw the same at bat from Max Kepler this season, just too much for me. Too much. He deserves the bench slot.
I think that's why, like you alluded to, I would absolutely trade him this offseason if we can, because there are going to be teams that are going to be tempted by he's going to have a better year because he's not going to have the shift to hit into the entire time. So it weirdly feels like a selling high for me with him, because I'm not convinced that it actually is going to get better next year.
Well, see, but that's the question, right? Because I don't know, like, unless the Twins are going to go out and sign a whole bunch of outfielders, which, I mean, I don't think they're in the Judge sweepstakes, obviously. And so with the injuries that we've had on the outfield side of the ball, I don't know what you can do to just trade away Kepler and being like, oh, well, we're going to be fine in the outfield. Did you look at our outfield lineup that it was towards the end of the season, who we were putting out there? Guys you haven't even heard of before.
Yeah, Mark Contreras, Gilberto Celestino. Who else was out there at the end of the season? I mean, it was dreadful.
Yeah, Nick Gordon. I mean, but you got to hope that like Larnach is going to be back and Kirilloff is going to be back.
What are you? You just sneaked Nick Gordon in there like some kind of a dilapidated extra?
No, I mean, come on. He was in Dan's MVP conversation. You can't just be saying he's just some guy in the outfield, though.
He was in my MVP conversation for like the fifth most important Twins player.
The fact that he was in the conversation, Dan, is the problem.
Most important for something that is like actually the abbreviation for most valuable. Yeah. We're just going to talk about the fifth.
All right. Can we move forward here to Rocco's Rewind? I think this will be fun.
Rocco's Rewind. Hogs, yours is blank. Do you have anything to say to Rocco on the season?
You really stole mine, David. So why don't you give yours? Because I really want to go off on this one.
So mine can be summed up pretty quickly. Too short a leash on starters and too long a leash on relievers. Rocco pulled our starters far too early, knowing that our bullpen was depleted. And there was just nothing that anybody could say, it seemed, to convince Rocco that just because a starter is seeing an opposing lineup for the third time doesn't immediately spell doom. And nobody at the same time could get it into Rocco's head that Emilio Pagan throwing out on the mound, basically, he would have been better off throwing underhanded for many of his outings here. You just couldn't convince Rocco that he's not the guy.
That's the part that frustrated me so much, because on paper, I have zero problem with the pull a guy before he goes through the lineup 3 times. The stats 100% agree with that. But the Twins situation this year was so clearly defined by starters who had decent outings. I mean, I'm talking about Gray and Ryan, who Gray would get pulled with 80 pitches. I would much rather have Gray go through the lineup 3 times, even if he's letting guys on base, than putting Emilio Pagan in those situations. And that's what killed me, because I think Rocco is managing correctly on an average team where your starters and your bullpen are the same level. We did not have a bullpen at the beginning of the year, and he treated it like we did. And if you're going to lose, you got to try to lose a different way sometimes, because if the bullpen keeps blowing those games, then try to let the starters go longer. It was incredibly frustrating to see our inability to adapt to that. At the end of the year, I understand we had Fulmer and we had Lopez, but it just wasn't the case at the beginning of the year. We lost too many games from the same guys instead of at least giving starters a go at it.
Do you think that alone was the difference between, say, winning that Guardian series in July that they lost in such heartbreaking fashion. I mean, or there were enough moments that you could say, yeah, that maybe cost them the season.
I think that's being a little bit too hyperbolic to give like that much on Rocco, because I think the injuries ultimately is what doomed them. And at the beginning of the year, the front office being just completely ambivalent about the fact that we didn't have a solid bullpen and we didn't have starter depth. So no, I don't put that the season on Rocco by any means, but it definitely played a role in some games. And in saying all of that, I like Rocco. I want him back next year because I think he is good for this team. It was just a weird deal to see him not be able to adapt to the cards that he was given.
Well, and it should be noted too, I'd like to see Rocco back as well. I don't want to see Tommy Watkins back, and yet the entirety of the coaching staff will return. However, they did let head athletic trainer Michael Salazar go, and I think that'll tie into what Dan has for Rocco.
So much of Rocco's decisions, especially early in the season, were about Byron Buxton and how he was managing him. And I know this goes hand in hand with the training staff, though now the fact that they fired their trainer makes me wonder a little bit more about this too. Did they manage Buxton the right way, or should they have had the surgery on Buxton that I think they said he would have been out, what, 6 weeks or so? And you figure, let's add a week or two of rehab. So let's say 2 months without Buxton, max, I would hope, at the core of the season. Were they better off letting him play through, or would you guys have rather have they shut him down?
That's an incredibly hard question to answer, because like hindsight being 2020, yeah, I would have rather had him at the end of the year when you're playing the Guardians 8 times and you still don't have him and he's not back. But at the time, I don't think when they put him on the IL that they thought it would be that long. I thought that they thought he would kind of come around a little bit better and come back. So I don't hate what they did, but I do like that they fired their head athletic trainer. Like, just hearing some stuff that came out that like Mally, who had shoulder weakness last year, wasn't doing any shoulder strengthening exercises, and then that's what ended up doing him in again. Like, that's preventative maintenance stuff that you should just not have issues with. And that was really frustrating. But with the Buxton thing, I think they did the best that they could given the information that they had. But if we would have known how long he was going to be out, then yeah, I think you do that surgery and try to make a push at the end of the year.
I mean, the question is, though, how many wins did Buxton attribute to at the beginning of the season to even put the Twins in a position for those 8 games to matter? And that's what we don't know.
That's true. And it's, again, too bad that he's got a knee injury, and you cannot question the guy's heart and his grit. You can just question his fragility in some sense. And that's just how it's going to be. And at the same time, I think they still got their money's worth out of him, quote, with this contract, that I think it again points to the fact that that's a pretty fair deal for Byron Buxton, given his injury history.
And it's still, it's not even that he's that injury prone. It's almost just the way he plays. Like, even that slide into second base, it was an aggressive slide to make that turn. He almost reminds me, like, Christian McCaffrey, I feel like, a little bit in the NFL, where he's always seeking out contact, but the guy's always hurt, but he's an incredible talent. And Buxton has that same thing, where part of what makes him so great is that he plays kind of with this reckless abandon sometimes, and that's why he gets hurt. I mean, you still have the weird ones like getting hit in the thumb with a ball and his thumb breaks, but I don't know. I don't feel like you can really even blame the guy for the injuries that he's gotten, because they're part of playing the game hard.
Well, and I do want to note, though, remember at the All-Star break, after the All-Star game, Buxton had a shot in his knee, a small procedure done. We talked about it at that time. But you do wonder at that point, if Buxton doesn't play in the All-Star game, he has that procedure and just uses those 4 or 5 days to rest up, does he play out the rest of the season?
I don't think so. I think if he needed a shot at that point of the season, it was going to happen in the next couple weeks anyway. And I think it was good to let him play in the All-Star game, because again, you're going to need Buxton to play more than, what, 12 games after the break, regardless of how things go. You needed, in order to win the division this year, they needed 130 games out of Buxton at least to make enough of a difference, I think, down the stretch.
I'm with Dan too. And that game is meaningful. Like, it really is. And it was cool to me that it showed that Buxton cared about it, because let's be honest, you can't question that guy's desire to get on the field. And so the fact that he wanted to play that game so bad, knowing that he would miss out on it, I think the guy has earned that to a certain extent by the years that he's had. And I know he's been hurt a lot, but I didn't hate that decision at all. I thought that was fine.
All right, well, let's keep going here. Next segment, Minnesota Moment.
Minnesota Moment.
So this is a segment where we try to pin down, usually at the series level, what was the defining moment of that series. Sometimes it's kind of the high point of the series for the Twins. Sometimes it's something that's very typically Minnesotan. And in this case, I think it's something that was kind of indicative of a larger trend or something bigger in the season. And also just kind of that key stretch perhaps. So Hoags, you already have something about Buxton. How about you go first?
Yeah, I think Buxton going on the IL was the defining moment of the season because that was the beginning of the end. When he got on the IL, we never came back around and we just didn't have it at the end of the year. And I think that injury was very indicative of what the entire season was for the... We can nitpick all we want about Rocco decisions or Watkins sending guys home or guys not having the years that they thought we had. But ultimately, if this was a healthy team, I think it's a playoff team. So I think the injuries and Buxton especially was what caused us to miss the playoffs this year.
I think it definitely played a significant factor. I don't know that Buxton alone, when stacked up against all of the injuries to the rotation and the bullpen, really, really matters as much, but it certainly played a factor.
Yeah, I look at their schedule. They were swept 7 times. They had 8 sweeps, which to me didn't feel very much. They played a lot of series where they lost 2 out of 3 or they won 2 out of 3. There was never a stretch where the Twins really lost a bunch in a row or won a bunch in a row. Like they just never quite, and especially the winning, they could just never quite get going. And I thought that was kind of it, where it was this team kind of caught in the middle where they had enough talent to stick with teams. That, especially, they ended up with a pretty good back end of their bullpen after the trade deadline. They ended up with seemingly enough starts and they had a good enough lineup to be able to kind of cover some of those other mistakes that they had. It is a little remarkable that they never, though, went on a terrible losing streak here. I guess towards the end, they kind of slipped, but they never totally fell apart mid-season amidst all the problems they had.
I think that's what was kind of so brutal about this team is every once in a while they'd sweep a team and then they'd win 2 out of 3 and you're like, okay, here we go. Now let's put some wins together. Let's get a lead in this division. And then they'd play the Dodgers or the Astros and get swept. And it just went back and forth so often and they just couldn't put a good stretch together.
Yeah, I think for me, the turning point of the season obviously was sort of the climax of the season where the Twins had a chance to actually make it interesting. But losing 4-5 against Cleveland in the way in which they did was just so incredibly frustrating. It just felt that, I said it at the time and I still stand by this, the Guardians are not the Yankees. And I think it just seemed like every time we went into these games against Guardians, it felt like, okay, well, yeah, the Twins are going to find a way to lose this. And it was so funny watching the Yankees get walked off by the Guardians in just crazy fashion. And I got to be honest, folks, I spent a decent amount of time looking at Yankee fan reaction videos when they got walked off by the Guardians, just because I needed something to warm my heart to sort of comfort me in this terrible Twin season.
Hold it. So in that moment, were you kind of rooting for the Guardians, like just a little bit?
I could not make it more clear. I am cheering for the Guardians to make it to the World Series, but I want the NL to win because I don't want the Guardians to win.
All right, I guess that's fair enough, Kufus. Well, let's move into Maurer's Musings here.
I just don't know how it can get any better.
Maurer's Musings.
Yeah, so Maurer's Musings is a segment where we sort of offer up a question about the team moving forward. And so normally this is on a, maybe this player is going to play better or if we're going to maybe switch things up in the lineup or the rotation. But so in this particular instance, we're looking at the team moving forward into 2023. What are outstanding questions or what are we thinking about as we start turning our gears looking towards next season?
So I'm actually going to change mine from what I have written down here. But do you guys think that with the front office, by all accounts, going all in at the trade deadline this year with Fulmer and Lopez and the brilliant Sandy Leone and with Tyler Mahle, do you think with everything falling apart that they're going to be less inclined to make a big deal at the trade deadline next year? Or do you think they're just not that results oriented? They're more analytical. But because to me, it seems like they finally went after it and they just got the crappiest result ever.
I can't imagine, you know, it was one of those sort of fluky things where it just seemed like everybody you traded for wasn't impactful for a number of different reasons. And so I would hope this wouldn't discourage the team from being willing to make those moves. But again, this Twins window, depending what they do with Correa, depending what happens with some of their other season signings, I don't know if they're going to be going all in the next three or four years. I think it's the next year or two where they can actually make a run and they could actually make a push at that midseason point.
It does really seem like we're at a tipping point just with the decisions that this front office can make and the amount of salary that we have available for next year. I could just see them going completely different ways. But what do you have, Dan, for the team going forward?
So it all is tied to Carlos Correa in so many ways, right? And what he does. This is a question. Do you see this scenario as possible? Could Polanco play a couple months at short, Nick Gordon at second, and you wait out Royce Lewis? And the reason that I say that is, what do you do at shortstop if you're not going to commit to one of these five or six big guys who are available and free agents? Is there a stopgap? Because they don't seem to have, I mean, they don't have Palacios now, which, not that he's the guy you want plugging in at shortstop, but like, who's going to play short on this team in the short term if it's not Correa, if it's not a big signing? Like, I don't know what they're going to do with that position.
I don't want it to be Polanco. Like, I really don't want it to be Polanco. He did not look good there, and he looks great at second base. I think that drastically improves our infield to have him there. And Royce Lewis is no sure bet. I mean, you tear your ACL twice now, and I don't know if you can come back from that. I hope he can. What do you do? What do you do if Correa's gone? It's a excellent question.
Obviously, the plan was to have Royce Lewis take over this year, but then he tore his ACL. You know, so it's like, I don't know what you do, Kufis.
I'm with Hoags. Polanco has to stay at second. He stayed healthier at second base. He looks more comfortable, and we don't have to deal with the airmail throws that he does when he's playing in the hole there. And I don't want Nick Gordon to be an everyday player at shortstop, even if we're just waiting and hoping that Royce Lewis is going to return and return to a decent form to play a shortstop. I think you don't go with a stopgap. I think you sign an actual shortstop, because I think a lot of Twins fans still remember what happened with Andrelton Simmons and how he was decent in the field, but he was absolutely terrible at the plate.
He was terrible in the field. I am so sick of people saying that he was decent in the field. He made more dumbs than anyone I've ever seen. I hated him in the field. All right, sorry, go ahead.
Anyway, but so I think a lot of Twins fans don't want to see that scenario repeat. And there are enough shortstops that are decent enough that the Twins can make a run at one of them. And I don't know. We'll talk about Correa in a couple of minutes here. But I do think that for this team to be successful, we can't be doing this with an important position like shortstop, just trying to fill in as we go.
Not to keep going down the rabbit hole, but shortstop's going to matter even more defensively next year, because the shift is going to be banned. So those guys won't be playing like a pseudo second base half the time. They will be in the hole at shortstop. And Polanco cannot do that.
Dave... Hoags, you brought up maybe the most painful thing that we could talk about, the banning of the shift. I don't know that we have space in this podcast to talk about that and the angst and the anger that I have at that. But you make an excellent point, because shortstop is so important. And here's the thing. I think if there's a position that you look at, teams investing in that position is the surest bet, I would think, in so many ways. Think of all the great shortstops that they've ever had. And here's the thing. When your shortstop gets old, you can move him to a different position. You can't move somebody else to play shortstop. I don't like the idea of moving Polanco there. I just think, what else do you do if you don't pony up and sign one of those guys? And I have my questions about whether they will pony up and give a guy $30, $40 million to play shortstop for them for 6 years.
But I think because they don't have to spend that money on starting pitching, and because their payroll is in such a good state right now, I do see them putting their chips on the table and putting some funds into that shortstop bank.
I mean, I hope so. I just think if you're this front office and you're going to do the starting pitcher thing where you're just going to try to cobble it together and get guys on good deals, yes, you have to invest that money somewhere. It's just a question of, will they be able to draw a shortstop to them, I think, more than anything.
Well, Correa loves it here. That's all I have to say. I mean,
and Hoag's, he loves that Dior store, wherever that is. So have you guys ever shopped at Dior? I have no idea what this store sells.
No, but Dan Hayes had a really funny quip here. He said that the Twins are more likely to shop at Fleet Farm.
That's the thing. Like, he wants to be here. So it's not about convincing a guy to be here. And Dan, I think this is the best point of it all. If you're worried about signing a guy like Correa, who's 28, I believe, right now, to a 6-7 year, $40 million, I mean, because that's what it's going to take. It is going to take a lot of money. You can move him somewhere else if his defense starts to play off, because guys entering into their 35th, 36th year, they're hitting drops, but not incredibly drastically. It's not ever heard of him for for him to still be a decent baseball player at that time. So,
and maybe Royce Lewis will be healthy enough to play in six seasons and he can finally take over. All right, David, well, do you have anything? We've talked over you quite a bit here.
Yeah, so I just want to say that there's a lot of talk about trading Urshela because it opens up third base for Miranda, and then obviously Arise can play more at first as opposed to second. And so, like, there's less of a timeshare between Arise and Polanco at second or Arise and Miranda at first. I don't know. I think Urshela at third is not terrible. And especially if he's not necessarily an everyday player, I don't know that I'd be so quick to try and move him.
Yeah, what are we even talking about here? Like, I don't get the whole conversation about getting rid of a guy who plays excellent defense at third base and hit .285. Like, what? Those guys don't grow on trees. You just, oh, yeah, you know what? Sure, fine. He's worth way more than $9 million, but we want Moran. There's going to be space. It's the whole stupid Josh Donaldson. Where's Luis Arias going to play? Well, Josh Donaldson's going to blow out his leg rounding first in the first game of the season. So I hate that argument. You have to keep Urshela. Like, he had an incredible year, and he's showing no signs of losing it, and he's solid defensively.
Yeah, I agree. I like having Gio Urshela there. I think he was such an upgrade over Josh Donaldson in so many ways. No controversy. And like you said, Hoax, there's going to be injuries. You can find space for players to play when you have a DH, a first base, a third base, and they can all play the spot. I think that's fine.
A couple other thoughts I had, but we don't need to really discuss them deeply. I think clearly this team needs to sign a catcher. There are a couple of big-name catchers available, certainly, so it'd be interesting to see if the Twins make a run at any of them. And then the only other question I had about the season as a whole is how much did Wes Johnson leaving impact this pitching staff? We talked about this a lot during the season, but clearly, if you look at this, especially now that we can look at a more macro picture, clearly Wes Johnson was important to this team.
I still think it's strange that he left midseason. I don't understand what dynamics were there. And he said all the right things, and those things obviously they're most likely true, but that's unprecedented, right? For a pitching coach to leave when you're in first place.
And to go to a college team, and he's leaving a Twins team that, by all accounts, Rocco pretty much let him completely manage the pitching staff. Like, he didn't really have a role in it at all. So yeah, that one's still going to be weird to get over. I don't like the fact that they're bringing Mackey back because it didn't seem like he really knew what he was doing at the end of the year. Maybe giving him another year will fix that, but I don't know. I wanted more turnover on the staff, to be honest.
I did too. I don't love the Mackey coming back because there's got to be somebody else out there who's a more veteran. You have a team that is a division contender. I don't think you want to leave that to a young pitching coach who's unproven. I just think that that's unwise.
Bring back Rick Anderson. That's all I'm saying.
Hey, there you go. Willis, Carl Willis is probably going to be available at some point. I mean, like, surely they could coax him over.
All right, well, let's go ahead and grade the season, not just the series, boys.
Series grades.
So if you're new to the podcast, this is a strange element of our show because we can never seem to agree on what actually constitutes each of these grades. David Graham's on a whim, right? I try to grade with some kind of rubric, but emotions get the best of me sometimes. And Hoags, I don't know. Do you have a system for your grading?
My system just solely relies on judging your guys' flawed systems. Like, you know, it's like pointing out the problem without a solution to it. That's the way that I go on this.
Again, I don't want to have to defend this every single time. But honestly, if we make a solid rubric, then this is no fun. This is no fun at all because you're just like, okay, how many games did they play? How many did they win? How many did they lose?
See, that's not the problem. That's not the problem we have with you, David. It's consistency. It's consistency in what you do. So I'm fine with you going with your heart, but they could like dominate a four-game series against the Guardians or something like that. And you could be like, well, they should have won the first game by more than 7 runs and they only won by 6. So I have to give them a D in this series. Like, your rubric makes, like, just consistency. That's all I ask for. That's it.
No, I just explained why there can't be consistency. It's like you don't even listen when I talk sometimes, Hoags.
All right, I'm going to grade first here because I have the most optimistic grade, actually. I have a C for this team.
How can you be optimistic when we're looking backwards?
Well, I have the most... That's a good point. I have the most charitable grade, I suppose, in the situation. C for charitable, because they finished about 500. That's about where we thought that they would go. And C is about 500, right?
I gave them a D for dreadful, because this was just awful. I wanted to give them an F, too. I really did. But the only reason I didn't is because this is what you said. This is kind of where we expected them to be. After April and May, if you would have told us that this is where we're looking at, none of us would be happy. So I gave them a D.
Yeah, I gave them a D as well, and partially because they at least kept it interesting, right? Like, we cared about these baseball games up through August for the most part.
How is that a D? That's got to be better than that.
I love how Dan gave them a C, and David and I both gave them Ds, and our argument was justifying why we didn't give them an F, because that's what they probably should have got.
Yeah, they should have. They came in third in the division. They were 14 games back from taking the division when they led the division through the All-Star break.
I can't believe I'm so strongly agreeing with David.
This is absolutely insanity.
Hold on. David, what would it have taken for you to give them a C even this season? Like, what would have been a C?
Yeah, they finished above 500 and not made the postseason.
Okay, so four games different? If they had won the White Sox series at the end of the season, then that's it for you? That's all it takes to move you, Kufis?
Four games. Maybe my math is wrong here. Hang on. Let me look at this.
82 and 80 would have been over 500, right? And they finished 78 and 84.
Well, yeah, that's not four more wins, though, Dan.
That's four. 82 is four more than 78.
Yeah, but what happens to those other losses? They just disappear? I'm a little bit confused how your grading works.
Instead of getting swept by the White Sox, if they would have swept the White Sox.
Yeah, or something like that, right? Let's say they win four more games in September when they're out of contention. That's still a C?
I don't even know what we're talking about anymore. All right. You asked me what it would have taken for a C. I gave you a response, and now you're making up. They played 190 games in this sort of anecdote that Dan has put before me. It's like, well, they would have won nine more games. It's like, well, what? Nine more? What are you talking about?
I said four more. If they won four games that they hadn't won, if they won four games that they lost, that's the difference between a D and a C to you. That's my point.
Yeah. Baseball is a game of very minor increments, Dan. I don't know what you want from me here.
All right, that's fine. I just think how they finished that last week of the season didn't matter anyway. So it just, anyway, we should just keep going.
I still don't know what we're talking about.
I do, and it makes it even funnier.
I don't know, Jack. It looked like Herbeck pulled him off the bag.
Herbie's Headlines.
Okay, Herbie's Headline. New segment this year, one of my favorite segments. We get to look around baseball and just kind of fit the Twins into some context around the league. We have a number of things you're going to talk about. Kufis, how about you go first?
Yeah, so I mean, just a quick shout out to Arise again for winning the batting title. And then I think that the two biggest takeaways that will at least stand up in the history books are obviously Judge breaking the AL home run record and then Pujols hitting 700 home runs. I think that those two things will stick around for a while. It is interesting, though, the AL East was historically good. I mean, that division was just insane at how many games they won. But so there were a lot of historical things happening this season and some pretty important baseball players who we're not going to see on the diamond next season.
Like Jake Cave? Is he going to be one of them?
No, he's going to be playing just for a different team, Dan.
That's going to be so sad.
I think the reason Dan liked this segment so much this year is because he could actually talk about Aaron Judge every single week if he wanted to, instead of only being able to do it whenever they would play the Yankees. But
you mentioned earlier how like they could possibly sign him as a free agent. I hadn't even considered that possibility. Aaron Judge in Twins jerseys and uniforms?
It'd be a little bit of an upgrade over Max Kepler, I think.
Well, David, I mean, you said that so flippantly as you are wont to do. And honestly, they went out and signed Correa last year. So anything can happen. I'd take Judge. I wouldn't say no. It's not my money.
No, nobody would. But I mean, this is just silly. I hate it when guys do that. Well, they signed Correa, so that means that the Twins are going to be in on every single top-tier free agent from now until eternity because they managed to get Correa in some weird Scott Boros opt-out deal. It just makes no sense to me.
Can you think of the puns? All Arise, the Judge is now in session.
Well, we need to talk about this. Did I mention this in the last podcast? It bothers me to no end that the Twins kept pushing this when Arise won the batting title. They're like, all Arise. And it's like, okay, it's over. He won. Like, what's the point of this right now? And by the way, the Yankees are in the postseason and all of the Twins players are at home in their boxers watching these baseball games crying.
Oh, Hoax, do you have anything to add here? All right. Well, I'm going to jump in. I'll jump in with my headline here. This was a great season for the mid-market team, right? So the Padres are, at least of this recording, they're in the NLCS. So good on them. They're hosting it as the 5 seed. The Orioles were competitive. They were part of that AL East resurgence, or at least the bottom resurged. And then the Mariners in the playoffs. I just thought this was a fun season. It was a shame, obviously, that the Twins weren't in that. But I thought that was good for baseball in some markets that love baseball. I mean, this is kind of akin to when the Royals are good. Like, Kansas City loves its Royals. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, David made a good point too. Like, regardless of how we stand on these new playoff rules this year, right, with introducing the extra team, that three game series was awesome. Like, it was really fun to watch, and there was a lot of baseball on every single day. And what you said too, Dan, it stunk that the Twins had been eliminated, because it kind of dampened that down, but it also, like I said, helped me heal a lot faster, because that was some great baseball those first couple of games. The Phillies coming back against the Cardinals, like as much as I don't like there being an extra team, this is so much better than the one game wild card, and I liked it.
If you're gonna have this number of teams, this is the way it should be done. Super entertaining. I hate to admit it, because again, I would limit it to four teams if I could from each league. But I do think if you're going to have this many teams make the postseason, yeah, they've definitely done the right setup to make baseball fans tune in and care.
And I like that there were no days off in that three game series, right? Just bang, 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 you get that done. It doesn't draw it out, because it shouldn't be drawn out, because the other teams want to play baseball. You know, as nice as it is to have a couple days off, you don't want to have a week off. You want to build that momentum and keep going.
The other thing I like about it too is that when you play those games back to back, that team that is going into the divisional series, that team that has the bye has a distinct advantage too, because the other team has already played those three games right away. So I like that. It's not only getting an advantage of getting a first round bye, but you have a team that's onto one of their lower starters and have to use their bullpen. And I just think that it's set up kind of nicely and really gives that advantage to a team and makes that regular season matter, not only to make the playoffs, but also to get that first round bye.
Let's go on to Puckett's Picks.
And we'll see you tomorrow.
Puckett's Picks.
So, folks, this is usually our last segment of the show, where we make a pick for the next series of the player that we think is going to perform best in that. We accrue some points throughout it, and then we have these standings, and I keep track of the points, and David keep track of the wins, and then we bicker about whose system is better.
All right, well, Dan, the only reason he mentions that is because he won. Like, now you got me saying it.
He said
now one. You got me saying it. No, the only thing that matters are the wins and the losses. Whoever scores the most in each series takes the victory for that series. Dan, we keep track of the points as a tiebreaker, but Dan has convinced himself in his head so that he can sleep at night that since he won the points totals, that matters somehow, even though that's not even a thing. It's strictly a tiebreaker.
All right. Well, Hoax, I think you should go first here as a listener stand-in here. Who are you taking for next season MVP?
I'm going with my optimism, my optimistic side. I'm going with my optimistic side, and I'm going to take Carlos Correa. With all the money that they have freed up, with how much more shortstop means to them, I think they're going to get it done. I think they're going to go out and sign him to a long-term contract. I think he's going to give them a little itty bit of a discount, and he's going to come back and play here, bring his championship culture to Minnesota, and we're going to see Carlos Correa in a Minnesota Twins uniform for years to come.
How many years do you think?
I think it's got to be at least seven, because I don't think they're going to want him to pay him the premium right away. I don't think they can afford it for like a five-year deal or a six-year deal, so I think they're going to have to stretch it out over seven. I'm thinking like 7 years, 280, something like that.
It's going to be higher, and it's going to be more years, no question.
All right, well, Kufis, since I guess you won, I get to pick next for what it's worth. I'm going to go with Luis Arraez. He's the batting champion. I think now the standard for him is to hit 300 every season. And to have a guy like him at the top of your lineup, that's pretty dang hard to replace. And if you figure, let's add Buxton in somewhere near the top of that lineup too. Carlos Correa, obviously, since now we know that he's coming back, at least in the eyes of Hoags. That is such a great punch. But I think Luis Arraez, seeing so many pitches, helping just frustrate other pitchers by having to throw so many against him. I just think that's such a huge advantage.
Real quick gut check, Dan. Does Correa come back?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I said it.
That was a quick response. Wow. Yeah, I think he does. For the reasons that Hoags has said, and I think I've convinced myself with that savvy shortstop argument. Yeah, I think Carlos is back, because I think he's the only shortstop, to Hoags' point, who would be, he's the one who's most likely to want to be here because he has already been here and says that he likes it.
I think the only thing is, I just think it's so out of character for the Twins, but then look at what they did at the trade deadline, and look that they signed him in the first place. Like, this front office is clearly doing things different than we've seen this Twins team do previously. Like Hoags has said, you know, obviously Correa likes it here. It does seem sincere, right? It doesn't seem like he's just saying that. However, I think that contract is going to get astronomical for him to stay here. I think it could easily be a 10-year deal that he's looking for crazy money.
Yeah, I think it could too, but if you look at their books, they are remarkably clean for the next couple of years, so they can afford to pay a guy like him 40 to 45 million and still be under that kind of self-imposed 140 million that they've kind of been sticking to lately, and he fits in that that with money to spare right now. So,
and think of how many Carlos Correa jerseys Hoags is going to buy. Like, oh, that's got to be worth something there, right?
They are in the cart as we speak. They are in the cart.
All right, Kufis, who's your MVP?
Yeah, I got to give it to Jose Miranda. I do think that he is going to continue after this rookie campaign. And really, it's a little bit disappointing that he was so overshadowed because so many rookies performed well this season. He wasn't even really in the conversation for Rookie of the Year, and he should have been in almost any other given year. But this year specifically, there was just so many other great players on the rookie level. I think next season, though, I think he's going to continue to progress, and I think he's going to be a hallmark for this team for the next 5 to 6 years.
I think if Marty Cordova can be the AL Rookie of the Year, I think Jose Miranda deserves that spot too.
Yeah, and I agree with you, David, too. I'm excited for what he's going to look like next year because you look at how he started when he got first called up and then he struggled, he got sent down, and then he just raked ever since then. So his numbers are so much better when you even take out that first little stretch that he had here that was just horrible. But yeah, I'm excited for him going forward.
Well, folks, thank you for listening to the end of this very long episode. Thank you also for listening all season. You know, normally we keep these things to about a half hour. We try to be a manageable, you know, kind of a drive time kind of length. Hoags, thank you so much for filling in. I thought this was great this year to have one fill-in host, especially because of all the man colds that David gets. Like, we needed somebody who could step up, you know, last minute, and you really did.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I really loved being on the podcast again this year. It's fun talking about the Twins, even on a year that this year that was so heartbreaking, but I got hope for next year. I think they're a playoff team, so I'm excited for where we're going
to
go.
Well, we will have you back to talk about that on the spring training episodes that will be coming up, I guess, in, you know, what 5 months until there's baseball again, David?
It's coming up quick. There's always more baseball.
All right. Well, David, if you would send us out here for the last time in 2022.
Well, folks, if you like what you hear, please tell a friend. You can follow us on Twitter at Men for the Win and find our Men for the Win Facebook page. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast to be notified when new episodes are available. And if you could leave us a rating, that'd be great. A reminder that our episodes are now available on our YouTube channel. And if you could drop us a like and a subscribe, we'd greatly appreciate it. Thanks for listening. And as always, go Twins.
That'll wrap up another episode of Men for the Win, a podcast hosted by David Kufis and Dan Thompson, two avid fans who appreciate well-played baseball, especially when it's done by the Twins. Thanks so much for listening, and as always, go Twins!